issues, forcing them to focus on her husband. Her husband, his blonde hair still streaked with sunshine from their months at Newport. Bay returned to his place on the edge of the bed, taking her hands in his, and Georgie let him, let the solid warmth of his fingers warm hers. The sun had been in her eyes. What had she seen, really? It seemed absurd to think she had seen her husband kissing another man. No, not her husband kissing another man kissing her husband. Had it been a kiss, even? Or just an embrace between friends? Friends did embrace. "I came back for my bag." The words were painful to speak, each word like a shard of glass on her tongue. "You were with Carrie's brother?" "Yes," he could say, "we were discussing torts, or we didn't want to bore you with law school memories." But he didn't. Georgie felt Bay's hands tighten on hers, too tight. His grip would have hurt if the pain hadn't all been located elsewhere, in the hunted expression on his face. "Charlie was my closest friend. In law school..." What happened in law school? The words were frozen on Georgie's tongue. She couldn't speak them. She wanted to shove the genie back in the bottle, to pretend she had never seen anything at all, to screw up her eyes and stick her fingers in her ears and chant, "Not listening," as children did. But she couldn't. She couldn't speak, and she couldn't look away. Bay bowed his head over her hands, his voice barely audible. "Charlie was the reason I left when I did. I had thought, if I could get away, he wanted..." A pause, in which the echo of the laughter and voices from downstairs sounded obscene, like a child's laughter at a funeral. "More than friendship." Georgie realized she was holding her breath, waiting for Bay to say more, to say something to reassure her. But he didn't. Rustily, she asked, "And what did you want?" "Not that." Bay released her hands, staring at the wallpaper as though for inspiration. I didn't want to spend my life ducking behind doors." "No, no, no." Bay's face swam in front of her, curiously out of focus. That wasn't what he was supposed to say. That wasn't an answer. Or maybe it was, and it just wasn't the answer she wanted. She could hear Sir Hugo's voice, a faraway buzz in her ear. "They have what is known as a mariage blanc." A mariage blanc. A fancy term for a marriage of convenience, for a man who didn't fancy women. Yes, but they were French, and that wasn't Bay. Bay, who had married her in spite of everything, who had told her he couldn't live without her, who had given her every indication of devotion, of tenderness. Oh, yes, he was all tenderness, especially in the marriage bed. Tenderness without passion. Devotion without desire. They had tried, goodness only knew they had tried, in Paris with the chestnut trees blooming outside the window and the Parisian air whispering romance. Bay had no experience of marital relations. She knew that. He had told her so himself. The act of love was an art, not a birthright. It wasn't surprising that their fumbling couplings had been more awkward than arousing. And Bay was so careful of her, almost reluctant. If Bay was tentative in his caresses, that was her past coming between them. Bay was protecting her sensibilities. Even now, now that she had tried to show him 100 times over that his embraces held no fear for her, how many times had she made a clumsy advance, only to have Bay gently stroke her cheek, kiss her forehead, close his arms around her in an embrace that was part affection, part deterrent. He had married a woman without family, without recourse. No, that wasn't Bay. Georgie's eyes ached with the strain of staring at her husband, at every line and crease of his face, the downward tilt of his mouth, the shadowed blue of his eyes, as if she might be able to see through the skin to the thoughts beneath. She wasn't being fair to him, to Bay. What had she seen, really? Painfully, she pushed herself to a sitting position. "You didn't ask him to press his attentions on you?"
"Don't pretend you didn't want this."
Giles's voice, a mocking echo. Louder now, too loud, Georgie said. "It's not your fault if someone presumes upon you."
Unless the presuming had gone the other way.
"No, but..." Bay swallowed hard, the bed listing as he leaned closer to her, his face a picture of unhappiness.
"I should have come with you back to the house. I should have seen you were ill."
Georgie's fingers groped for her husband's. Somehow, if she could touch him, it would be all right. There was something about the physical presence of Bay, his touch, his smell, that soothed fears. "I'm not ill."
Bay gave her hand a quick squeeze. "You've been pale for days now, and don't tell me it was the lobster mousse."
Georgie stared up at Bay, feeling herself falling back into the old patterns. If Bay looked guilty, it was because he had failed in his duty to her, leaving her to make her way to the house alone. That was all. So easy just to banter back, to let the familiarity of his voice, his manner, lull her into pretending nothing had happened. And what had? If anyone had kissed anyone, it had been Charlie kissing Bay. Bay, she realized with a pang, had been far more generous with her than she with him. He had never once presumed to blame her for losing her virtue to Giles. How was this any different? Except that she knew that she had once desired Giles. Was that why she was presuming guilt? Because she knew herself guilty? No, Bay had made her see that she was wrong. If she was guilty of anything, it had been unworldliness. And maybe that was all Bay had done as well, had blundered into what he thought was a friendship. Sir Hugo winked at her from a gallery in Paris.
"I cede him to you."
"Georgie?"
Bay chafed her wrists, his brow furrowed with very real concern.
"If you won't confide in me, will you at least speak frankly to the doctor? Having come this far, I don't want to risk losing you now."
"I'm not sick," Georgie repeated. Pushing herself upright against the pillow, she made her decision. She looked Bay in the eye and said boldly, "I'm increasing." Bay blinked at her.
"Do you mean..."
He was looking at her as though she was all the angels and Mary rolled into one. "It does happen, you know."
Bay's throat worked, but no words came out.
"It's hardly the virgin birth," said Georgie tartly.
"No, I..."
He looked as though someone had just bashed him on the head with an oar. Georgie was tempted to hold up two fingers in front of his eyes and ask him how many he saw.
"You aren't going to swoon on me, are you? Because that probably wouldn't be good for the baby."
"The baby,"
Bay repeated, and Georgie saw that his eyes were suspiciously bright. He drew in a ragged breath.
"Our baby."
And before Georgie could say anything else, her husband seized her in a fierce embrace, his head buried in the crook of her shoulder, his hair tickling her neck.
"Our baby," he breathed,
making her squirm as his breath went down the back of her neck.
"The lobster mousse,"
Georgie croaked, and Bay let go, his hair mussed, his face glowing with wonder, glowing so that she couldn't help but smile back at him, helplessly, just for a moment, before there was a discreet knock at the door, and a voice said dubiously,
"I was told someone was in need of a doctor?"
"Yes,"
said Bay, standing and becoming Bay again, at ease and in charge, overriding Georgie's no.
"Yes, we are in need of a doctor."
It was amazing how all-consuming he or she came to be, this person they couldn't yet see or hear, although by December Georgie had begun to feel movements, movements like a sea monster undulating under the water.
"It's not nice to refer to our child as a sea monster," Bay said when Georgie expressed that opinion.
"How do you know?" said Georgie, shifting uncomfortably on her chaise. She had been fitted with a special corset for her condition, but it seemed to poke even more than the ordinary kind.
"We haven't met him yet. He might be beastly."
"With you as a mother?" said Bay gallantly.
Georgie stuck out her tongue at him.
"If Dr. Greeley keeps me on a decreasing diet, I refuse to answer for the consequences."
Her husband set down the papers he was reviewing. Not legal documents, but blueprints. Plans for the house they were to build on a plot farther uptown, all the way up in the East 70s. Georgie might have been more enthusiastic about the plan had it not adjoined an empty plot already purchased by her mother-in-law.
"Didn't I sneak up half a ham last night?" said Bay virtuously.
"Hardly half a ham."
But that wasn't the point. They shouldn't have to sneak. Dr. Greeley was Mrs. Van Dyvel's doctor, the decreasing plan his decreasing plan. Georgie was sick of decreasing, and she was particularly sick of Mrs. Van Dyvel, who had planned their lives to the minute. Every day Bay went dutifully to the office, of which the senior partner was Mrs. Van Dyvel's brother, Peter Bayard. Every evening he attended his mother and sister at one of the many events that marked the season, while Georgie, by virtue of her indelicate state, was confined at home to a chaise lounge. Without ham. Georgie swung her legs over the edge of the chaise, moving cumbersomely to a sitting position. With Christmas approaching, the whirl of gaiety was reaching frenzied proportions, a fact to which Georgie could only attest by the increasing carriage traffic outside her window.
"Couldn't we go somewhere? Somewhere away?"
"The mountains of the moon?" suggested Bay. Georgie gave him a look.
Bay settled back in his chair.
"We could go to Florida once the season is over."
"I don't want to go to Florida."
It came out sounding petulant. But wasn't she entitled to be petulant? She was increasing, which apparently rendered her unfit for everything, including eating. She might at least get some benefit out of it.
"It will just be all the same rules in Florida, and no ham."
They made a sympathetic face.
"When we have our own house," he began.
"You have four houses," Georgie said crossly, "none of which you occupy."
"Yes, but the Florida house is let, and the Newport house is really more my mother's."
Bay broke off, a strange expression crossing his face.
"Bay?"
Georgie waved a hand. "I'm supposed to be the one in a strange state, not you."
"I can't believe I didn't think of it before," said Bay, looking like a little boy who had just found a toy under his pillow.
"Newport?" said Georgie dubiously. The place had felt like a marble mausoleum in the summer. She couldn't imagine how grim it would be in the winter.
"No, not Newport. Dyvel's Kill."
He grinned at her with such unfettered delight that Georgie couldn't help grinning back, even if she felt there must be something quite wrong with a house with death in the name.
"She'll never follow us there. Of course, this isn't really the time of year for it, but my grandparents lived there year-round and didn't mind the snow. It is somewhat isolated."
"Bay, I was raised in the country. I'm not afraid of a few trees."
Georgie felt a surge of optimism. Isolated meant Mrs. Van Dyvel wouldn't be there to tell her to stay in bed, or to tell the cook what she couldn't eat, or to inform her that her corset wasn't laced tightly enough, or to ask her to retire from the drawing room because heaven forbid anyone see what they already knew, that there was a perfectly legitimate child making a bump beneath her dress.
"Didn't Dr. Greeley say I might benefit from country air?"
The mention of Dr. Greeley had been a mistake. Bay's smile faded.
"I didn't think. What if you need a physician?"
"I wouldn't trust Dr. Greeley to deliver kittens," said Georgie bluntly.
Is there a midwife near this house of yours?
Bay looked doubtful, but he said, There is Mrs. Garrett. She's housekeeper now, such as it is, but she was my nurse when I was very young.
Only when you were very young?
Bay cast her a sheepish glance. She didn't get along with my mother.
Well, then, said Georgie, there couldn't be any better recommendation than that. Can't you send someone to her and tell her to open the house? Nothing elaborate, we won't be entertaining. We'll just need rooms made up for us. And a nursery.
Bay's eyes met hers, and she knew she had him.
The notion of going elsewhere, being by themselves again, felt like the promise of rain after a drought. No coughing in the ever-present coal smoke, no being shooed back indoors lest someone get a glimpse of the younger Mrs. Van Dyvel's expanding stomach, no endless list of do's and don'ts. And no worries about what Bay might be doing without her. Despite their comfort together, despite Bay's obvious joy over their child, there were nights when Georgie would sit on that thrice-blasted chaise lounge, and the clock would chime midnight, and she would wonder if there was a Charlie Ogden at the ball, drawing Bay away to a library or a disused anteroom. She believed Bay when he said he didn't want Charlie's attentions. She did. And she knew, because Bay had told her offhandedly, as if it were just another piece of society gossip, that Charlie was spending the season in the nation's capital, tied up with a case that was to be heard before the Supreme Court, although what the case was Bay didn't say, and Georgie didn't ask. She didn't want to talk about Charlie or think about Charlie, but sometimes Charlie wandered into her mind all the same. Charlie and Sir Hugo. And it was those times that she heard Annabelle's voice in her head, Annabelle mocking as only she could mock.
Really, Georgie, why did you think he would marry you if not for that?
But never when Bay was with her, as they were now.
Just think of it, said Georgie coaxingly. No coal smoke, no omnibuses.
Bay leaned his head against the back of his chair.
No balls or receptions or endless nights at the opera.
Georgie was briefly diverted.
I thought you liked music.
Bay stifled a yawn. He had had another late night with his mother and sister, another night when Georgie paced their room alone, listening to the carriage wheels beneath the window.
Does anyone go to the opera to listen to music? My mother never arrives until the middle of the first act, and we generally leave before the second.
He turned his head sideways.
There's a pianoforte at Dival's Kill.
Georgie could feel the smile starting to curve her lips.
Is that a proposition?
Call it a proposal, or perhaps an invitation.
Rising, Bay went down on one knee before the chaise.
Mrs. Van Dyvel, may I persuade you to elope with me to Dyvel's Kill?
Can you elope if you're already married?
Asked Georgie. And then,
we really must think of a better name.
Bay grinned at her, his face alight, and Georgie wondered if he had been chafing at his mother's regime as much as she.
Illyria, then. Come along, Cesario. We'll break the news to my mother.
Chapter 16 New York, 1899, February.
It distresses me deeply to be the bearer of bad tidings.
Mr. Tilden, Mrs. Van Dyvel's lawyer, was deeply apologetic. Janie rearranged the folds of her skirt and kept her head bowed. With the drapes drawn and no fire lit, her mother's parlor contrived at once to be both stuffy and cold. After a week in the country, the house on 36th Street felt like a prison. All the more so for the cordon still in place outside, as the crowd pressed in, trying to sneak glimpses through the shuttered windows.
"Scandal on the Hudson!" screamed the journal. "Bayard Van Dyvel's affair with cousin who was raised as his sister."
The world was more direct, if no less sensational.
Cuckold or adulterer, Bayard Van Dyvels cited in cousin's divorce. Teddy Newland, apparently, could not be reached for comment on his yacht in the Riviera. His lawyers refused to confirm or deny the charge. But that didn't stop the Journal from stretching the story until it squeaked. The city was ripe with speculation. Annabel Van Dyvel had discovered her husband's affair with his cousin and killed him and herself. No, no, it was Bayard Van Dyvel who was the wronged party, and Annabel who was the adulteress. Warring camps took sides. Omnibus drivers and chemists wrote letters to the editor in which they thrashed out the relative merits of each side. A former maid at Illyria came forward with stories of scandalous goings-on that boosted the journal's circulation dramatically, until it was proved by the world that the so-called maid had, in fact, never set foot in the house. It was Mr. Burke's name on the byline of that article, tearing the maid's story to shreds. Discrediting the journal was his job, after all, but Janie couldn't help but feel obscurely heartened all the same. It made her feel as though she had a champion in the lists, someone ready to wield his pen on her behalf. The fancy made her half smile to herself, silly as it was, fountain pens in the place of lances, papers for shields, and Mr. Burke, in a bowler hat in place of a visor. They had met twice more since Illyria, stolen moments in City Hall Park beside the statue of Nathan Hale. Once he told her that his colleagues in London had identified the name of the actress on the program as Georgina Evans, not Georgiana Smith, and the second time he warned her that the date of the inquest had been set, and that Janie, her mother, and Anne were all to be called to testify. The official notice had arrived hours later, presented by a harried Mr. Tilden. It had been easier than Janie expected to pretend she knew nothing about it, largely because no one ever imagined she might. As always, she sat in a chair a little behind the others, draped in crepe and dullness. Janie Van Dyvel, who never did anything improper. Except that she had, and she wasn't sorry. She was only sorry that the opportunity hadn't arisen again. Did that make her shameless? Perhaps. Or perhaps it merely made her honest. She could still feel the burn in her skin from the wind, nipping her cheeks, making her feel alive. She had attended the most exclusive balls in the city, danced with New York's most eligible bachelors, and yet she had never felt so alive as when she stood in City Hall Park with a reporter of no family, burning her lips, eating hot chestnuts out of a twist of newspaper. Mr. Burke had taken the paper away, insisting that she allow him to test them for her. Janie had reclaimed her prize, protesting that it hardly counted as gallantry to eat them all before they cooled. "Even if I save you from a scorched tongue?" he'd countered.
"You don't seem to be suffering," Janie retorted.
"How do you know?" he'd said, and there was something in the way he'd said it that made her hastily return her attention to the chestnuts. They both sobered quickly enough when Mr. Burke told her about the impending summons, but the thought of the afternoon still brought a glow to Janie's chest, burned lips, frozen fingers and all. For a moment, she had felt like anyone else, like Katie, who might walk out with a charming man on her half-day simply for the pleasure of being in his company. It was nonsense, of course. Theirs was a partnership, possibly even a friendship. She had felt more herself in their brief acquaintance than she had with anyone since her father had died. But anything else was...
"Impossible!"
Janie's mother said so forcibly that Janie half feared she had said something aloud. But Mrs. Van Dyvel's ire was directed at the hapless Mr. Tilden.
"The coroner must be aware that we are a household in mourning."
Mr. Tilden gave a delicate cough.
"If you have been called, you must testify at the coroner's inquest. Your bereavement is, I fear, no excuse under the law."
"Barbaric," pronounced Mrs. Van Dyvel, white-lipped. "Would they make me exhume my son so they might batten on his body?"
Mrs. Van Dyvel looked, for the first time, old. Janie felt a sudden twinge of conscience. Her mother was so strong, so so armored, that sometimes Janie forgot that she was grieving, that it was her heart and not just her family pride that was aching. Mr. Tilden took a cautious sip of his sherry.
"If it is any consolation," he offered, "it is highly unlikely that you will be called to the stand, Mrs. Van Dyvel. I believe your summons was a mere formality."
"To force me to dwell on my son's death so that they may all glory in my grief?" Mrs. Van Dyvel's nostrils flared. Janie reached out a hand to cover her mother's. Mrs. Van Dyvel brushed it away, saying brusquely, "And what of my daughter? Must she be subjected to this farce?"
It was cold in the room, bitter cold, but a fine sheen of sweat could be observed upon the lawyer's brow. Mr. Tilden wasn't, thought Janie with some sympathy, accustomed to dealing with such matters. True, telling disgruntled relatives that they were to receive, after all, no bequest must be unpleasant, but it wasn't on the same order as court proceedings relating to unnatural death. To his credit, Mr. Tilden had done his best to refer them to a lawyer who did specialize in what he euphemistically referred to as such matters, but Mrs. Van Dyvel was adamant in her refusal. Entrust their private affairs to the sort of man who consorted with criminals and wore loud waistcoats? Never. Useless to protest that not every trial lawyer was a William Howe, the flamboyant defender. Mrs. Van Dyvel's mind was made up. Mr. Tilden had spent years drinking her sherry. He could very well guide them through the thicket of the coroner's court without flinging them on the mercies of low people with large fees.
"Miss Van Dyvel,"
Mr. Tilden tilted his head in Janie's direction in a courtly gesture, then did the same for Anne.
"And Mrs. Newland will undoubtedly be questioned as to their observations upon, discovering Mr. Van Dyvel."
"I see," said Mrs. Van Dyvel bitterly. "There was a time when an unmarried girl would not be put on display in such a way. But perhaps I am behind the times. I must offer up my offspring to the vulgarity of every passing member of the public who might take a fancy to enter the courtroom."
"For what it is worth, I do not believe that is the coroner's purpose. He hopes, as do we all, to discover the method of Mr. Van Dyvel's untimely death."
Mr. Tilden looked longingly towards the sherry. Mrs. Van Dyvel ignored him.
"Then why, I ask you, have they not done so already? It is nothing but sensation-seeking. We should be allowed to bury our dead in peace, or such peace as we may find in this fallen world."
Mr. Tilden shifted nervously. Mrs. Van Dyvel's peculiar mixture of grief and gall left him unsure whether to proffer a handkerchief or back slowly towards the door. Taking pity, Janie moved soft-footed to the decanter, holding it over Mr. Tilden's glass. Mr. Tilden gave her a look of real gratitude.
"If I might presume to offer some advice, it is always best to say as little as possible when being questioned. Answer with a simple yes or no to all questions that bear of such answer, and do not succumb to the temptation to elaborate."
He lowered his voice as though speaking of something slightly indelicate.
"It gives the members of the Fourth Estate less meat for their speculations."
Mrs. Van Dyvel rose from her chair, moving restlessly across the room.
"The press will invent what they lack."
She stopped in front of Anne, favoring her with a look of naked distaste.
"We have my niece's indiscretions to thank for that."
Anne lounged back in her chair, with a poor imitation of her usual grace.
"You do me too much credit."
Mr. Tilden cleared his throat again.
"If you would permit me, might I tender my apologies on behalf of my colleagues, the confidential papers referring to—"
He looked from Mrs. Van Dyvel to Anne, finding himself incapable of voicing the term divorce.
"Ought never have been made available to the press. Mr. Newland's attorney, Mr. Archibald Newland,
has informed me that the guilty party has been let go. It was most unprofessional. Most unprofessional.
That was not the indiscretion to which I referred.
It is hard, isn't it? Murmured Anne, when there are so many from which to choose.
Janie shot her a warning look, but Anne only shrugged. Ignoring her daughter and her niece, Mrs. Van Dyvel turned to Mr. Tilden, her voice like steel.
10 years ago? Was it that long ago?
Anne smiled brightly at Janie's mother.
It feels like just yesterday, perhaps because you keep reminding me of it.
10 years ago, continued Mrs. Van Dyvel grimly, Anne attempted to elope with an actor. He had, of course, expectations of her fortune.
Anne made a minute adjustment to the French lace at her cuffs.
Such a pity my father squandered it all. Or perhaps not. Had he been more provident, Aunt Alva, you should have had to pay far more for a house in Newport.
The lawyer sucked in his lips. Janie winced at the raw vitriol in her cousin's voice. Mrs. Van Dyvel's eyes narrowed.
Had you been more provident, Anne, we might have been spared this circus. Or do you mean to tell us that our persecution by Mr. Burke of the world is none of your doing?
Mr. Burke? Janie interjected.
Nobody paid the least attention to her.
Did you think I hadn't noticed? Said Mrs. Van Dyvel to Anne. I hope you are pleased. Your lover has finally found a means of bringing even greater disgrace upon our name.
Sharply, Anne said,
The press was never going to ignore a man with a knife in his chest.
Mrs. Van Dyvel's words came out one by one, soft and deadly.
You will not speak of my son that way.
Why not?
Anne tried for bravado, but Janie saw her blink hard.
I saw him that way. You didn't. You didn't.
Mrs. Van Dyvel's chest rose and fell. The only sound in the room was the rattle of her jet beads and the ticking of the clock.
I would prefer, she said through clenched teeth, to remember Bayard as he was.
Anne swallowed an ugly laugh.
You mean as you would have liked him to be?
Mrs. Van Dyvel's lips tightened, but she recovered herself magnificently, her voice strengthening as she took command of the conversation.
Have you renewed your acquaintance with Mr. Burke? Have you betrayed your family for your lover?
Mr. Burke. Janie could feel her face go hot and cold.
Lover? Anne's lover?
I got my start performing in Mr. Hearn's plays.
That was what Mr. Burke had told her. He had been an actor once.
No, there must be dozens of men named Burke in the city. Hundreds.
But how many who had acted at Daly's Theatre and wrote for the World?
My lover?
Anne gave a bitter laugh.
How you exaggerate! I haven't set eyes on Mr. Burke since you dragged me back here.
You mean, said Mrs. Van Dyvel with satisfaction, that your Mr. Burke dropped you quickly enough once he discovered you had no money.
You'll never catch a duke if you're not an heiress.
Anne's voice was sharp.
Don't you mean once you had him thrashed out of his pretensions?
Really, Anne, we are hardly so barbaric as that. I simply made sure that Mr. Burke was reminded of his position.
Groveling and tugging his forelock?
There were lines on either side of Anne's lips.
When I went back to the theater, I was told there was no one of that name. I sometimes wondered just what you might have done to him.
Don't be dramatic, Anne, said Mrs. Van Dyvel.
Bickering with her niece acted on Mrs. Van Dyvel like a tonic. The sickly look on her face when they spoke of Bay was gone, replaced by her usual majestic complacence.
All I did was have a word with Mr. Daly. He quite understood the delicacy of the matter.
You mean you had him sacked?
Anne tipped her head back and breathed in deeply.
How terribly humane of you! No gouging out his eyes for daring to gaze on his betters, then?
"You're kind," Mr. Burke had called her. "Gaunt-plated."
"If I might beg your pardon."
Mr. Tilden half rose from his chair.
"Another engagement?"
Innocent until proven guilty. That was the principle, wasn't it? She was the one who had sought him out, proposed their partnership. But only after she had found him in her mother's kitchen. She could still taste the chestnuts on her lips, feel the press of his hand on hers. Saint Genevieve, he had called her, bringing light to the world, challenging her, debating with her, using her?
It might not.
Janie scarcely knew what she was saying.
It might not be the same man. Burke is not an uncommon name.
Don't be foolish, Janie.
Mrs. Van Dyvel rose from her chair to see Mr. Tilden to the door. She looked pointedly at Anne.
The man vowed revenge, and now he has it. I hope he is satisfied.
She sailed out, Mr. Tilden trailing behind her.
Anne, wait!
Janie scurried after her cousin, stopping her before she could follow.
Is it true?
Is what true?
Anne asked impatiently.
That the reporter was...
My lover?
It was impossible to be sure whether Anne was trying to shock her, or if she was just so used to shocking everyone that she did it automatically.
How would I know? I haven't seen the man in a decade.
But...
Did he have green eyes? Was his voice polished and smooth with something rough beneath? Had he held her hands and told her she was his candle in a dark world?
I should think you would remember him. After all, you tried to run away with him.
Anne shrugged.
He looked well in breeches. There was a scene in which he fenced. Really, Janie, you remember what it was like. Wouldn't you have run away, too, if someone had asked?
Chapter 17 New York, 1899 February
Miss Van Dyvel?
One of Janie's students cautiously waved a hand. Every woman in the room, from 12-year-old Tilda to Mary Frances, who allowed as she might be upwards of 40, had read the papers and knew of the scandal hanging over Janie. But no one had breathed a word of it. They just treated Janie as though she were one of the chipped pieces of porcelain on the table, handling her with clumsy care.
Where does the funny-shaped fork go?
That's your fish fork.
With an effort, Janie recalled herself to the task at hand, six women standing around a scarred table, incongruously draped in damask.
It goes to the left, here.
Solemnly, Mary Frances moved the fish fork to the correct location. After a look from her, the other women did the same with theirs. Janie took a deep breath.
This knife is the fish knife. If there is no fish course, you will not need to use either, of course. We have no fish course today, so we can set them aside.
Then why'd we have them?
Muttered Gert, eyeing the tableware with mistrust. Her fingers, wrapped in her skirt, were rough and work-reddened.
So we know what to do with them, Miss Impertinence,
snapped back Mary Fran.
Now you mind, Miss.
Thank you.
Janie took a deep breath.
Now the table is set. You may take your seats. Place your napkins on your laps.
Tuesday was etiquette, a chance to instruct on the setting of a table, table manners, and incidentally to provide a meal to women too proud to admit they might need one. All the women paid their own way. Tilda, at 12, supported an indisposed mother, two younger siblings, and a perpetually out-of-work stepfather. These stolen afternoons at the girls' club were their chance at betterment, their one moment to themselves, and Janie tried to make them worth their while. But today she couldn't quite get her mind to focus. Half a dozen times she had set out purposefully for the streetcar. Half a dozen times she had turned back,
the hot phrases dying on her lips. What was she to say to him? Did you elope with my cousin? Have you been lying to me? Why ask when she knew the answer would be yes? Unless it wasn't. Or it was, but there was an excuse. More acting, more lying. Janie could feel her muscles bunched tight in her back, all of her strained to the breaking point. Who could she talk to? There was no one. The only person who knew she had been meeting with Burke was Burke. She was ashamed, so terribly ashamed, of how badly she wanted to be convinced that she was wrong, that her mother was mistaken, that Anne was lying, that it had all been a misunderstanding, that there was another actor named Burke, that everything had occurred exactly as she had believed, that she had sought him out, not the other way around, that they were a team, partners. Except they never had been, had they? He hadn't lied to her about that. She'd known Burke was using her for a story. But that had been all right. That had been a use that she understood. Something that might be tempered, possibly, by, call it friendship, or even fondness. Revenge was another matter entirely, something wild and unpredictable. What was it he had said to her back in the darkened house? If you can say that, Miss Van Dyvel, you've never been in love. Had he loved Anne like that? Loved her to distraction? To madness? She didn't want to know. She didn't. Except she did. When Janie caught herself biting her fingernails as she hadn't since her mother had had her nails painted with iodine, she had set her spine and announced she was going back to the girls' club to resume her classes. The resulting hue and cry was almost a relief. Her mother's anger, Anne's amusement, all afforded her occupation for her mind, a vent for her emotions. Her mother's grudging, "Do what you like, then. You are of age," had felt like a major triumph. Until she found the note from Burke waiting for her at the club. "Where are you? Has something happened?" And it all came rushing back again, tenfold, the hurt and confusion and anger and doubt. She had been right to come back to the girls' club. Janie knew that. But she was far too aware of the golden globe of the world building looming a mere block away. And beneath it, Mr. Burke. There was a rap at the door, and Maisie stuck her head through.
"Miss Van Dyvel, there's a gentleman to see you."
"A gentleman?" Janie had been about to serve the soup, which slopped onto the damask tablecloth. She gave a small cry of distress. Tilda jumped forward with a napkin.
"What gentleman?" Mr. Burke?"
When Janie hesitated, Maisie added,
"He was very insistent. Would you like me to tell him to go?"
Behind Maisie, Janie could see the shadow of a man in a dark coat. And so could all the women in the room, all of whom were looking with interest at the newcomer.
"Here."
Janie thrust the ladle at Mary Fran.
"Would you mind filling the bowls? I won't be a moment."
"Oh, no. Yes, miss. Not at all."
A chorus of assent followed Janie out the door as she slid through, trying to make herself as narrow as possible underneath the scrutiny of half a dozen pairs of eyes. In the hall stood the source of it all, hat in his hand, smiling at her as though he walked into women's clubs every day of his life. Which perhaps he did. What did she know of him, after all, other than what he had told her? Or rather, not told her.
"What are you doing here?"
asked Janie flatly, and had the satisfaction of seeing Mr. Burke's smile slip a bit.
"The mountain wouldn't come to Mahomet, so..."
He took a step forward, turning his hat in his hands.
"When I didn't hear from you, I began to worry. I thought perhaps your mother had locked you in a tower and thrown away the key."
"As you can see, I am quite at liberty."
Janie steeled herself against the caress of his voice. Glancing over her shoulder, she said stiffly,
"They shouldn't have admitted you. There are no gentlemen allowed on the premises."
"I thought we'd agreed I wasn't one."
When she didn't smile in return, Mr. Burke took a step forward, his face a study in concern.
Is something wrong?
Only everything, she wanted to say.
It was some black magic in him or some weakness in her that despite it all she yearned to confide in him, to treat him as the solution rather than the problem. It was that way he had of looking at her as though she were all that mattered in the world. Had he looked at Anne like that 10 years ago?
"Walk with me," Janie said.
"Anywhere," began Mr. Burke, but Janie cut him off.
"Down the hall will do."
When they were in the alcove by the back door, Janie stopped and turned. She could see Mr. Burke's shoes, scuffed and worn against the carpet runner someone had donated 3 years ago. Without preamble, Janie said,
"A decade ago, my cousin attempted to elope with an actor from Mr. Daly's theater. She was retrieved, and the actor, I understand, made to lose his position."
She looked up to find that Mr. Burke's face had gone blank.
"That's a very politic way of putting it," he said.
Janie's teeth dug into her lower lip.
"But accurate?"
He let out a long sigh.
"Such as it is."
"Such as it is?"
Janie echoed. She felt frozen, her wits gone sluggish. "What are you talking about?" he was meant to have said.
"In what way is it incorrect?"
"Not so much incorrect as incomplete."
Mr. Burke shoved his hands into his pockets and looked down at her, his brows raised.
"There's a sequel to the story, of course, but I think you already know it. Mr. Daly, who was a kind man, put in a word with the theater critic at The World, who pulled a string here and a string there, and found the actor a job delivering papers."
"You,"
said Janie, the words scraped from the back of her throat.
"You didn't tell me."
"It didn't seem relevant."
Mr. Burke followed her as Janie yanked blindly on the handle of the door and stumbled out into the patch of flagstone that they called a garden.
"And it was a long time ago."
The cold hit Janie like a slap.
10 years ago.
12, Mr. Burke corrected her quickly, trying to catch her eye. "It was 12 years ago."
12 years ago. Why not? What difference does 2 years make, more or less?
Janie put out a hand and felt the scratchy wood of the garden wall against her palm.
"Janie?"
Mr. Burke's hand touched her shoulder. Janie moved sharply away. An expression of annoyance crossing his face, Burke rested one hand on the wall next to her head.
"Miss Van Dyvel, look. When I got the news about your brother, I'll admit it, there was a certain, oh, I don't know. Did I want to rub your mother's nose in the dirt? Yes, of course I did. But it was mostly about the story. That's my job, getting the story. What happened 12 years ago happened 12 years ago. When you came to see me..."
The wall scraped against the back of Janie's dress.
"You saw an easy mark?"
"I admired your guts," he said roughly. "I admired you."
For a moment they stood like that, close enough to kiss. And then sanity returned, and Janie pushed away from the wall, treading on Mr. Burke's foot in the process.
"Like you admired Anne?"
Mr. Burke emitted a muffled curse as he shifted from one foot to the other.
"I barely knew your cousin. I was 16. People do stupid things at 16. I won't lie to you."
Janie could hear herself emitting a very unladylike snort. Mr. Burke winced but pressed on.
"I flirted with her. I was flattered. Who wouldn't be? But I wasn't in love with her."
Janie glared up at him.
"Then why did you elope with her?"
"I didn't elope with her."
Vaguely, Janie was aware of heads sticking out of the windows above, people leaning out to listen. But Burke was there, in front of her, his expression strained, blotting out everything else.
"Your cousin showed up with her bandboxes and told me we were running away together. That was all. I never meant... It was a stupid mistake, that was all."
"How naive do you think I am?"
Janie wrapped her hands in the folds of her skirt, as though that could stop their shaking.
"My mother had you stripped of your livelihood. That's not the sort of thing you forget.
Mr. Burke scraped a hand through his hair. Believe it or not, but your mother did me a good turn when she had me turned off. I hated the stage. When you're on stage, you can't see for the lights in your eyes. Not to mention I was a miserable actor.
Janie's eyes stung from the wind. I'd say you were a very good one. You've been performing with me for weeks.
It hasn't all been a performance.
The all cut like a knife. Realizing his mistake, Mr. Burke winced.
Janie, believe me.
Believe you? Janie couldn't keep the incredulity out of her voice. The wind was making her cheeks burn and her chest hollow. How you must have laughed when I came to you. Revenge offered up on a silver plate.
Not silver, said Mr. Burke, so softly his words were barely audible above the wind. Gold.
It wasn't fair of him to look at her like that, as though she were a lady in a portrait and he her swain, when in fact it had all been a lie from start to finish. Janie's hands felt like ice, but her chest burned.
I want you to leave, Mr. Burke, she said,
her voice cold and hard and steady.
Leave now.
Please, let me try to explain.
Mr. Burke put out a hand to her. He wasn't wearing his gloves, Janie noticed, and his fingers were blue from the cold.
Miss Van Dyvel. Genevieve.
It was his use of her name that stiffened Janie's spine and her resolve. Sharply, she said,
There are women waiting for me inside. You may have all the time in the world, but they don't.
Mr. Burke made a deprecating face.
Surely 10 minutes.
Did he think that 10 minutes was all it would take to wheedle her around? Janie grasped the handle of the door, tugging against the wind.
You may not value their time, but I do. These are women who took time out of earning their livings because they want to better themselves.
Mr. Burke grasped the door above her hand, holding it for her.
By learning which fork to use?
Don't you dare mock them!
Janie swirled through the door in a tangle of worsted and indignation.
Knowing how to set a table could make the difference between getting a position in a big house and no work at all.
So you're training your own servants, retorted Burke. How noble.
I never claimed to be noble, snapped Janie. I learn far more from them than they do from me. But what little I can share, I do. Can you say you do the same?
Burke took a step back, holding up a hand defensively.
I inform the public.
And charge them for it, too, riposted Janie. 3 pennies a paper.
We can't all live on Fifth Avenue, Burke shot back. Some of us have to earn a wage.
Janie felt a magnificent rage swell through her.
I won't deny that my family wronged you, Mr. Burke, but I refuse to be part of your revenge. And I refuse to be made to feel guilty for what I am. I couldn't help it any more than you. You, at least, have the power to go out into the world and earn your own wage, while I—
Yes, said Burke.
The memory of all the empty years came flooding back. The hours of hiding in her room, hiding from her mother, hiding from herself. But she'd had enough. She wasn't hiding any more.
I teach table manners, and I won't keep my students waiting. There's a gate in the garden. I suggest you use it.
And she left Mr. Burke standing alone in the winter bare garden, feeling at the same time both very powerful and very bereft. Cold Spring, 1896. May.
Duck, Mama, duck!
Georgie raised a hand in response to her daughter, who was already toddling past, Polly the duck bobbing up and down on her string, Bast stumbling along behind, making grabs for the duck's wooden tail. The weather had finally turned, and the day was just warm enough to play outdoors, the children reveling in the bright new grass, in the freedom of the wide lawn that stretched away along the back of the house, as their nurse darted behind them, ready to catch them if they should tumble. It felt like heaven to be outdoors again, to feel the sun through the brim of her hat, to watch her children, play.
The old white house seemed to smile behind them, brighter for a new coat of paint, but otherwise unchanged from the day Bay had brought her there over a year before. Georgie had fallen in love with the place at once, although whether it had been the house itself, with its quaint simplicity, or the simple fact that it was an hour from Bay's mother, she couldn't say. It had been expected that they would return to town eventually, but the birth hadn't been an easy one. Society had agreed that it was admirable, if a bit baffling, that Bay would stay with his wife as she recovered. It had become less admirable and a great deal more baffling as they had stayed and stayed and stayed, even as Georgie regained her health. Illyria, Bay had jokingly called the house when they had first arrived. But that was what it felt like to Georgie, an enchanted kingdom where they might do as they pleased. And if she felt a bit restless from time to time as her health and spirits returned to her, well, that was surely a product of the dark, cold winter months, when the house felt less welcoming and more confining. But the sun was out again, and the children were beginning to cease being mere ciphers and become people, a transformation that Bay, in particular, watched with no little fascination.
"Duck, Mama!"
Viola called again. Viola was just over a year old, and already saying words, or at least a handful of them. Bay thought her quite brilliant. Sebastian was quieter, but easier on his feet, building up the blocks Viola knocked down, picking up the toys she dropped. Was that what it had been like with her and George? Georgie couldn't remember, and there was no one now to tell her. But she could remember the feel of her brother's hand in hers, even now. There were times when she couldn't believe her luck, that through all the ups and downs, the uneasy times, she had come to this peaceful place where she was undisputed mistress, where she could watch her children play and know that they would never have to wonder who their mother was or face the scorn of society. There were other times when a cloud would pass over the sun, and she would shiver, sure that a reckoning would come. The air above her darkened, and a pair of hands settled on her shoulders, making her jump. "Hello," said her husband, leaning around her hat to press a kiss to her cheek.
"You startled me."
Georgie tilted her head back, feeling the sun on her face.
"You're back early?"
Bay took the train to town twice a week to maintain his presence at the office. Georgie still found it strange that a man who could afford a private train car would deem it necessary to report to an office like a clerk, to do work that he didn't need to do, but she accepted that this was part of Bay's world, a world in which the arbiters of society lived far more opulently than dukes, and yet still played at the professions.
"I didn't go to the office," Bay confessed, folding himself comfortably onto the ground at her feet. "I have a surprise for you."
"Dada, dada, dada!"
Polly the Duck clanked behind Viola as she toddled toward her father with surprising speed. She tripped over her own fat little feet, and her father swooped her up, kissing her round cheeks. Viola went to her father, but Bast came to Georgie, wrapping his arms around her leg just below the knee. Georgie nuzzled his head, smelling the perfect baby smell of him.
"What sort of surprise? Not another patent carpet cleaner. Mrs. Garrett nearly resigned."
Bay smiled sheepishly.
"Nothing that explodes this time, I promise."
He rolled onto his back, lifting a delighted Viola squealing into the air.
"I won't tell you. You'll have to come to town to see."
Georgie looked at him darkly.
"This isn't another of your mother's plots."
"To make us understand the importance of our position?" Bay finished for her.
He lowered Viola gently to the ground, casting a quick look at Georgie.
"No, it's at Anne's house."
Georgie hauled Sebastian onto her lap, where he promptly wriggled to be free again.
"Haven't she and Teddy gone to Nice?"
"I believe their trip has been postponed."
Bay looked uncomfortable.
"There was some disagreement. I don't really know."
That he did know, Georgie had no doubt. There had been times over the past 2 years when she had badgered Bay to betray his cousin's confidences. He generally did in the end, but since Georgie had very little interest in Anne's domestic dramas, other than to ascertain that they would have no repercussions for Bay, and since Bay had long been aware that Georgie's sympathy for